succession were 31554, reel 2.
Harry Leach, reel 1, side 2. So you you were sideline judge and sort of enjoyed the sport from the sidelines, in effect.
Being as I am, not very tall, I was no good at sprinting, but I can run all day without any problem at all. Cross-country running is my, or was my, best sport, and I used to thoroughly enjoy it. In fact, had it not been for the fact that I was engaged farming and I came out of the army, I would have perhaps had a go at the marathon. I don't know, but I could just run all day, no problem at all.
A good advantage for people, troops on the move, wasn't it, to be able to,
yes,
to be able to do that?
Yes.
Yeah. So, anyway, you were telling me you got to a holding camp prior to D-Day. Did you get any pre-disembarkment leave to say goodbye to
your
parents?
Oh, yes, we had leave beforehand. Yeah. But once you were in the holding camp, mm, and the briefing started, you were not allowed out. And there was one of our chaps, his wife was in hospital. I think she was having a baby, and he was not allowed out to go to see her, which is fair enough.
So how long were you in the holding camp?
From memory, I should think about a week to 10 days. The only time we went out, it was beautiful weather before D-Day itself, and we were taken down to the Thames, and those of us who could swim were in the water, because there were hundreds of us, not a stitch of clothing on, and of course all the holiday boats going up and down, must have been quite a thrill.
So lots of rumours and anticipation. Were people nervous what was to come, or eager to get there?
I suppose everybody takes it according to their own lights.
How did you feel?
You had some trepidation of the unknown. Is that the right word? But I have faith, and I knew I was trained well. I knew my colleagues wouldn't let me down, and I would take it as it came. The second operation, which we'll come to later, is a bit different because you knew what you were going into. D-Day, there were very, very few of us had seen action. A few of the senior NCOs who were ex-regular soldiers had been in action in India and probably the Middle East. And they were a tower of strength. I remember some very, very good fellows in our section who are on the photograph of the section that you've seen.
So you were about 20 at this
time? I was 20 on the 8th of March 1944, so I was plus 3 months on D-Day, almost to the day.
So after the long wait, what happened to you then?
After the
long wait?
Oh, well, it wasn't all that long. We were training all the time.
Yeah.
Then we got in the trucks to go to the airfield in the evening, because D-Day, we started at midnight, and driving through the villages to the Gloucestershire villages, all the people had a very, very good idea that this was going to be it. And we went to Fairford, where we gathered round, we were already in our, they call it a stick, that's the number of men in your aircraft, and we gathered round our aircraft, and Padre Parry, who was the Padre for the 7th Parachute Battalion and our brigade headquarters, came round, and he asked us if we'd like a little prayer, and we were singing Abide With Me. So as we were singing Abide With Me, the first aero engine started up, and within 5 minutes, you couldn't hear yourself think. Mm. Hundreds and hundreds of aircraft engines thundering away. Sadly, Padre Parry was murdered on D-Day. He was tending, this is what I've been told, and I believe it's true. He was tending wounded with some medics, and I have only been told this. Anyway, he was killed on D-Day. He was a wonderful young man.
So how many people do you think left from Fairford that night? How many people from the airborne left from Fairford that night? Was it just the 5th Brigade, or would all the paras go from there?
I don't know exactly how many, but there were dozens and dozens of Stirlings, and I don't know who was in the others, because you're in your own little...
You didn't have any gliders with you?
Oh, I kept well away from gliders. They're too darn dangerous.
So you had no experience of jumping out of them, of the gliders, during your training?
They normally didn't parachute from gliders.
No.
The lads who went in the gliders didn't have chutes.
Oh, no, of course, they lights landed.
Yes.
If they were lucky.
Yes.
So you all went into your relative planes.
Yes.
And then what happened?
We took off. Of course, it was just coming dark then. Remember, it was June, and the nights are pretty well as light as they will be. We climbed away and settled down for a relatively short flight, because I think we took off about 11 o'clock in the evening, and we jumped at about 1:15. And
did you know before you left exactly where you were going?
Oh yes,
our
briefing was in the airborne was very, very thorough. We knew exactly what we were doing. We knew exactly what the objectives of our battalions were. We knew also who was alongside on each side. We knew who would be relieving us eventually if all went well.
How long did they say you could expect to wait before relief?
The briefing was that Lord Lovat's commandos would arrive at Pegasus Bridge, as it is now named, at 1 o'clock on the morning of D-Day. At about 1 o'clock, we heard the most sweet music I've ever heard. Bill Millen, Lord Lovat's piper, who lives near here in Tynmouth, playing his pipes. So we knew we were not alone. From there on, more and more. Okay.
So as the planes opened and you bailed out, there were masses of planes around you. Did you have much flak as you came in?
It was in the dark. Mm. As we flew in to France, I remember looking out of the port, it was the left-hand side of the aircraft, and I could see Le Havre burning from air raids and I think naval guns as well. We flew in over the beach, which would be the beaches later in the day, and then our dear pilot started weaving the aircraft, that is, swinging the aircraft from side to side. What the so-and-so he was trying to do, I don't know, because we were not being hit by flak. I had that experience later on the Rhine, which made it very, very difficult for us all to get out. So we were, as we jumped, we were much further separated. However, I landed in a tree, and I have been able, since that day, about 10 years ago, I was able to find the exact spot. I was over with my son and grandson, and I said to them, I know this was the area I landed, because there was a crossroads. We were off the main dropping zone, but as it happened, not very far, but of course it was pitch black and we didn't know. And I said, there was that little cottage, which is then, after the war, just a heap of rubble. And it was somewhere down here. And we looked around and looked around, and I said, well, let's have a look down this little lane, which is called Rue du Marécais, or Du Marécais. We walked down, and I said, right, Chris, this is it. Because I landed in some trees on this little, very tiny lane with a ditch on one side. And I said, here we are, this is where I landed, with just on, within about 50 yards of here, this is my spot. We then walked up to the end, where we met the rest of the, several of the chaps in our aircraft, and one of whom was Sergeant Bass, old dear old Doodle, his nickname was. So we didn't know where the heck we were, because we weren't on the dropping zone. And they said, look up, and the aircraft will be flying north to south. So when four aircraft had gone over in four different directions, we sort of said, well, so we came to this little cottage. And so I said to Doodle, well, look, I speak enough French. Get down behind the wall, and I'll go and knock on the door. If I drop flat, shoot. Don't argue, just shoot, because a German's opened the door. So I knocked on this cottage door, and I could hear voices inside, and then the bolts were drawn, and I was dragged into the cottage. However, it was a French family, and I would love to have been able to meet them again. But so all I could really remember was Le Pont Tournant, which was the swing bridge over the River Orne. Ah, monsieur, the way to the Pont, this was of course in French, which I was trying to interpret, the way to the Pont Tournant is à gauche. Pas à gauche, pas à gauche, mitrailleurs. So I had no idea what he meant. So I went back to the to Doodle, and I said, well, the way is down that road to the left. But the old man said, don't go that way, mitrailleurs. And I said, I don't know what mitrailleurs is. So Doodle said, well, fair enough, we'll take it for as the truth. And we got out. We knew now where we were, and we'll go around in a circle. At this, a patrol of one of our battalions came up with a colonel. Ah, he said, you fellows, follow me. So Doodle said, in the dark, drop back. So we dropped back and left them. We heard in a couple of minutes what a mitrailleuse was. It's a machine gun. So we ambled out onto what I now know is the dropping zone. We're out in the middle, Birchay, Doodle, and several others. And as the gliders at 3 a.m. started coming in, and that's not very nice because you can't see them coming. There's no lights on and there's no engine noise. There's just a swoosh and a crash and a clatter. We walked on, making up, we now knew roughly where we were going, and we met Brigadier Poet and his escort and few men, and we joined them. And then a bit later on we met General Gale and his escort, and whereupon somebody's Sten gun went off, and I don't know who, and all we could hear from General Gale's party was, the buggers have got me, the buggers have got me. One poor lad had obviously received a bullet or two in his leg. He wasn't badly hurt. So then we carried on with Brigadier Poet and arrived in Romville, where the brigade headquarters, we were initially set up in Le Bas de Romville, but that was only for, I don't remember how long, not many hours, and then we moved into the chateau, which was five para-brigades headquarters for the whole time we were in Romville before we moved forward to Le Mesnil and other places.
So, did you have much German resistance as you moved forward?
Yes, we had quite a big attack came through on the day after. We were on, we were being shelled and mortared continually.
How many people actually landed safely? Did you have many losses? Or?
Our section, we were very lucky. We lost our second in command a few minutes after he landed, and we didn't have any more deaths that I know of until later on, and we had two, Ken Thompson and Pat Leatherbarrow. Ken Thompson was the same as I was, and Pat Leatherbarrow was a glorious lad, one of our drivers. They were both killed, and I visit their graves every time I go.
So you set up, so you had to make what connection to the other para units just to see where everybody was and
yes.
What's happening?
We set up our headquarters in this chateau, and I go back every year to visit it, and we have our signal office just inside the front door of the telephone exchange, and of course lines out to all the units that were part of our brigade at the time, and we carried on from there. There was a big attack on the day after D-Day, D plus one, and thereby hangs another tale. When I got home, I was talking to Mum and Dad, and my mother was not what you call a religious person. In fact, her old pal said, you know, your Mabel might not go to church more than twice a year, but she's the biggest bloody Christian I know. And Mum said, I mentioned this, and she said, well, a friend of ours, their son was killed about 1942. He was training as a pilot, and he deliberately crashed his aircraft in the River Humber because he had engine failure, and he was killed. Now, my mum was a very level-headed lady, and I was talking about this, and she said, well, she said, I was snoozing after lunch in bed, and Brian, that's this lad who was killed, came rushing into the bedroom, and he said, Derek, that's my family nickname, it's not my Christian name, is in terrible danger. He's terrible danger, but he's all right. Now, we know that happened on D-Day. There was some connection Mum had. She said, I know it was the day after you landed. I can't explain it, but I know, my mum, it did happen.
So, did much of your equipment get damaged, or did it all land quite safely? I know in future drops, the valves were damaged, weren't they?
On D-Day, I had all my equipment in the kit bag. I had everything that I set out with. Various other people lost the kit bags. You know, I've no idea what they had, but we had sufficient equipment to set up the signal office and work the brigade signals from there on. Our radios went, you know, with the battalions, etc.
So the rest of the 5th Battalion, were they...
Brigade.
Were deployed to protect the headquarters?
Yes. In the brigade headquarters, there was what they called the defence platoon. This was, I think, 30 or 40 men of the parachute regiment, whose job was guarding the headquarters, plus, of course, our own very, very wonderful military police. They were wonderful men.
And so you say you stayed there for how long?
We stayed in Romville. I cannot be certain of dates, but I should think we were probably there at least a couple of weeks or 3 weeks, with, you know, German attacks in the district. But we were never essentially in terrible danger. We were strafed on one occasion, and we were shelled and mortared constantly. And then later on, we moved forward to a farm at a little place called Le Mesnil, and that was our headquarters for quite a while. I've never been back to that particular farm. Romville is my main place I go back to. And then from there, eventually, we moved forward, as in the photograph you've got there, and that was us advancing towards... Eventually, we would reach the River Seine. one morning I was in the signal office and Brigadier Poet came in and he said, oh, he said, where's Corporal Lando? Ted was Brigadier's personal wireless operator. And I said, I'm afraid he's gone for his breakfast. So he said, right, come with me. So I went with Brigadier Poet, working his radio in the back of the Jeep, and we drove into a little town called Pont-l'Evêque, where the leading battalion was held up. And Brigadier Poet jumped out of the Jeep and left me sitting in the Jeep in the square. And he said, call me if anything comes through. So I was sitting there, shall I say, not very happy. And all the houses burning all round the square. And 1947, when I came home from the army, I went to work as a pupil for a farm manager before I went to university. And on this farm were three Germans, prisoners. There was Big Willy, a huge Bavarian peasant, the strongest man I've ever seen. There was Eric, who was an older man, well in his 40s, and the other two said Eric was not what he claimed to be. He wasn't a Gefreiter corporal. He had a Gefreiter's uniform, he had a pay book, but they said he was Gestapo or something. And the third was Heinz, who was a German parachutist opposite us. And Heinz and I became very good friends. And he went to Russia with his battalion, or regiment as they call them, and he was one of six that came back. And I was telling him about this Pont-l'Evêque, and he started laughing, because I knew the German paras were there. Ah, he said, and I was the bugger that set them houses on fire. And he said, I was running up the road too. It's a small world.
It is. So, you got back safely, obviously, from being with him, yes.
Yes.
And did you enjoy going out with them, rather than with the commanding officer, rather than being back at the headquarters?
Yes. Brigadier Poet he's dead now. Of course, he became General Sir Nigel. He was a wonderful man. He was a kind of man who you would go anywhere with, anywhere. He was wonderful. And of course, we got to know him quite well, but we were working in the brigade headquarters, so we saw a fair bit of him, and he used to come into the signal office and make any, whatever request he wanted. And he was a man, you would do everything for him.
Did you live off the land? Or did you get local eggs and chickens and stuff? Or did you live on rations?
Yes. Well, of course, most of the French people were evacuated because it was a war zone. But in Le Mesnil, in this farmhouse, a girl who I think was sort of like, must have been like a dairymaid, and a boy who was obviously worked on the farm, and we used to be able to get milk and cheese, you know, what's the French cheese I'm thinking of?
They do Pont-l'Evêque.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was very badly wounded. He was walking not far away from my trench, and mortar bombs came down, and he was badly wounded in the head. I don't know what happened to him. And the girl was then sent back out of the way. It was too dangerous for her.
So your accommodation, were you sleeping
in trenches?
In trenches, yeah.
That's the only safe place to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
You make your trench normally so that you can stand up, and soil level is just about chin level. And then you pile heavy timbers, whatever, doors on top, and a mound of earth on top of that, and that will stop any splinters from air bursts, but it won't, obviously, if a bomb lands on the top of your trench, it's too late.
So you were all dug in effect?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes, you had to be.
Yeah. So did you have sort of dugout for the actual signals headquarters?
Yes. The signals office The brigade headquarters was in a little farmhouse, which was sandbagged, and then our signal office was in the little garage, and that was heavily sandbagged, and we worked that on rotors.
And you were aware from the signals coming in just how well people were or weren't doing around you?
We were always, apart from that, we were always very well briefed. We knew a great deal of what was going on and what was being done and what was trying to be done. I think possibly more than in an ordinary brigade, an ordinary infantry brigade.
So did you feel that the war, it was going well, because they obviously at Hill 112 they had a great setback and Conn was very difficult to take, wasn't it?
I wouldn't say that we knew the war was going well. We knew exactly what was going on round us. Mm. We knew which battalions were in an attack, which were suffering casualties, because we had two teams of three wireless operators attached to each battalion, and we knew from them what was going on. And I think possibly we were kept pretty much informed of what was happening around us.
Did you have casualty clearing stations near you?
Yes.
And they would be like sorted out and then taken out to the Mulberry Harbour?
A casualty, we had one or two in our section. It would be picked up immediately and treated by the medics on the spot and taken to the casualty clearing station. In Ronville, the number 225 parachute field ambulance was in Ronville in one of the chateaus, very handy. I remember one day we had a very, very heavy German artillery and mortar blitz, and when it quietened down I was testing the telephone lines on the exchange and I had no reply from anybody. They were all cut except one, and the voice answered, and it was 225 parafield ambulance. So I said, oh good. I said, you're the only line I've got alive. Well, laddie, said Colonel McEwen, can you imagine a better one you'd rather have? He was a gentleman. He was a great man, Colonel McEwen.
When the lines were broken like that, did you have to go and rewire them? Or?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah, not me. No. We had what was called a line section. Mm. And their job was laying telephone lines, repairing telephone lines, a very hazardous job on occasion. Mm. Once, one night, we never sent them out at night unless we had to. Each battalion would have at least a dozen telephone lines. And one night, I think it was probably the 12th battalion, all our lines were cut. So the corporal who was in charge of the line section was called Darkey Waters. He got the military medal, well deserved. So I woke him up and I said, I'm sorry, Darkey, I've got to send you out. So off they went. So then the light came up on the exchange, and he always used to call me young'un. Is that you, young'un? I said, yes, Darkey. He said, we found the break, and then they put a new reel on and find the end. So he came up and said, we found the other end. I'll ring you in a minute. So he rang. The light came on the exchange, and a deep voice said, oh, which is that? You could hear the silence out there. A little voice said, was that you, young'un? I said, no, Darkey. Oh, dear. Well, he didn't quite say, oh, dear. He said something else. We're getting out of here. And eventually, we found that they'd found the break, joined the reel of cable on, gone out through our battalion lines, through the German lines, and had connected up to a German exchange. Our German interpreter, I believe, was put on the phone to see what he could find.
So the normal thing with the airborne is that you would just go for quite a short time till the artillery and the infantry took over, and you would carry on. But obviously you stayed longer than that. Why was that?
Yes, that's correct. The two main objectives of 6th Airborne Division on D-Day was Le Pont Tournant over the River Orne and the bascule bridge over the Canal du Con, which is now called Pegasus Bridge. And our objectives were to hold those two. And there were other objectives which were not as vital. One of being blowing the bridge over the River Dives, and this, I gather, was done by a party